Russian President Vladimir Putin defends Moscow's military action in Ukraine, saying that NATO was creating threats at his country's borders. Iran says that a visit by the EU Deputy Foreign Policy Chief to Tehran will put the talks for the revival of the 2015 agreement on the right path. And also in headlines, the Hamas resistance movement condemning the fatal shooting of three Palestinians by Israeli forces. It says the killing proved that the regime is gripped by fear. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The top story this hour, Russia's Victory Day celebrations underway as we speak in the capital, Moscow. The annual event commemorates the defeat of Nazi Germany in the Second World War. The celebrations started with a massive military parade. Then President Vladimir Putin delivered his speech in Moscow's Red Square. He congratulated Russian military forces for their victories throughout history. Putin condemned what he called the moral degradation of the West, saying that his country will not deviate from its traditional values. The Russian president called the expansion of the NATO alliance a direct threat to his country, accusing the West of plotting to invade Russian lands. He said that Russian forces involved in the military action in Ukraine are fighting for the security of their motherland, adding that those fighting the Donbas region resemble the heroes of the Second World War. The United States and its allies have imposed more sanctions on Russia in response to its war on Ukraine. To discuss that further, we're earlier in the news review program joined by our guests who shared with us their views on that story.
So now for our news review segment where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. Now, the United States and its allies imposed more sanctions on Russia in response to its war on Ukraine. The leaders of the Group of Seven Nations say they would phase out or ban the import of Russian oil in a timely and orderly fashion. The European Union also echoed the call by saying the 27-nation bloc is getting closer to agreeing tough sanctions against Russia that include a ban on oil purchase. However, the bloc faces a challenge to secure oil supplies to landlocked Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, which all depend heavily on Russian crude. Meanwhile, the United States said it had imposed sanctions on 27 executives from Russia's gas exporter, Gazprom Bank, and three Russian television networks. Washington also imposed visa restrictions on more than 2,500 members of Russia's military, while sanctioning eight Russian maritime companies and nearly 70 vessels. Joining us for more on this story is Keaton Mansfield, author and analyst at the Center for Political Innovation from Austin, Texas, and also E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars magazine from South Bend, Indiana. Gentlemen, welcome. Keaton, if I start with you, I mean, more sanctions on Russia. Will these sanctions end the war, or do the sanctions have other purposes?
I don't think they're going to end the war. I mean, we're into our third month, I believe, of the special operation in Ukraine, and it doesn't look like, despite the fact that the U.S. continues to ramp up its sanctions against Russia, it doesn't seem that Russia is going to cave. And so then the question becomes, what's the motive here? I mean, are we trying to collapse our own economy? Just yesterday, I was filling up my car with gas, and you have gas at something like $4.60. That is not a sustainable price for Americans. And what's going to actually happen is the Gulf states have already said, we don't have any more oil to give the United States. And if we're sanctioning Gazprom, the U.S. is going to collapse its own petrol industry. And Europe is already, especially Germany, has already seen that it can't shut off Russia and do whatever the U.S. and NATO wants without destroying its own country.
Okay, let's get Mr. E. Michael Jones's perspective. Mr. Jones, those who are imposing sanctions, why are they not backing the peace process?
Well, the United States is engaged in a proxy war with Russia that they conceive of as the second Afghanistan. So this is a war where they think that Russia is going to expend all of its military and financial capital in a pointless battle, which they will lose after long haul, and that will lead to the collapse of Russia in the same way that the Afghanistan war led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think that's the American goal in here. That's why they're not negotiating. This thing could have been ended with negotiation before it started. But this is the long-term goal. Now, in order to do that, they planned sanctions. The sanctions were supposed to crash the Russian economy. That hasn't happened. And now they're going to sanction energy. And the main victim of this is going to be Europe. Why is Europe going along? Because their members, NATO was basically a control mechanism for Europe. And now these people are stuck in it. Now, from the point of view of the Russians, the fact that they survived this far means that it didn't work, and now the sanctions will strengthen them, because sanctions are tariffs. Over the long haul, this will lead to the domestic production, which is exactly what happened in Iran, where the sanctions led to increased domestic production. That's the long-term scenario. In Europe, it's going to lead to the crash of the manufacturing economy of Germany. And so at that point, you're shifting from economic to psychological parameters, because it's not in Germany's interest to go along with NATO and crash their own industrial economy.
Okay, gentlemen, bear with me for a moment while we take a look at some social media reactions to this story. Our first comment is from Pelpwa, who says the goal of the dying US empire is to keep Putin involved in a multi-year war, to weaken Russia's military and to use sanctions to destroy their economy until Russian citizens turn against him so they can replace him with a puppet to give US access to their resources. It's not working. Next up is Sagassian, who says, when will the West understand that you will save a lot more Ukrainian lives if you negotiated with Russia? Sending Ukraine weapons will only prolong their suffering. Russia can endure sanctions for years. The incompetence of the West is unreal. Jorgen says Russia defies predictions of collapse. Russian economy has not collapsed under US-led sanctions, defying Western expectations. And then finally, State Ahead says European banks reveal isolation of Russia costing billions in losses. Global watchdog warns sanctions will only make energy crisis worse. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your time and your thoughts. Let me thank our guests. Keaton Mansfield is an author and analyst with the Center for Political Innovation, joining us from Austin, Texas, and E. Michael Jones, the editor at Culture Wars magazine that is from South Bend, Indiana. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this news broadcast. Iran saying that a visit by the EU Deputy Foreign Policy Chief to Tehran will put the talks for the revival of the 2015 deal on the right path. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Enrique Mora's upcoming visit will focus on the proposals made by the EU Foreign Policy Chief during his recent phone call with the Iranian Foreign Minister. He stressed that the visit is part of the ongoing process of exchange of messages between Iran and the P4+1. Within the Vienna talks. Khatibzadeh said Iran and the group have been committed to a good and reliable agreement despite anti-diplomatic moves by U.S. Congress. The official said that Iran is ready for an agreement as part of Vienna talks immediately if Washington accepts the Iranian people's rights. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has hailed the Syrian nation for remaining steadfast during the years-long war in the Arab country. He was speaking with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad here in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei said that Syria's victory in that war has brought it respect and credibility. He also spoke about relations between Tehran and Damascus, saying that both governments are determined to further expand cooperation. The Syrian president also praised Iran for supporting his country, as well as the resistance front in the region. Al-Assad held separate talks with his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi, too. They discussed regional issues and bilateral ties. Raisi said that the resistance of regional countries would result in a new order in West Asia. Al-Assad said that Syria's ties with Iran are strategic. The one-day trip was Assad's second visit to Tehran since the war broke out in Syria in 2011. Journalist and political commentator Mohsen Abbas says that the Syrian president's visit to Iran is a sign of a strategic partnership between the two countries, and he explains why the visit is important.
This meeting is a kind of another flag to all those who may be thinking that President Assad might loosen his alliance with Iran. Of course, the trade between Iran and Iraq is essential, about 20 billion in an annual terms there. Also translates to Syria, because of course, you know, the pathway for the Islamic Republic of Iran to Syria goes through Iraq. And of course, they've got very strong alliances with the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi forces out there as well. This is a pivotal alliance which also the Israelis and the Arabs, the Zio Arabs and the Americans want to break. I think President Assad arriving in Tehran at this moment is very, very important for so many reasons. The first and foremost is declaring its ongoing partnership and friendship and strategic friendship with Iran with good reason.
Israel is pushing ahead with atrocities against Palestinians. The regime forces have killed three more people in separate attacks across the occupied West Bank. One victim, Mahmoud Sami Aram, succumbed to his wounds after he was shot near the city of Tulkarm. The Israeli army claimed that he was trying to cross a barrier separating the occupied territories. Another Palestinian was killed in Al Quds over the allegation that he tried to stab an Israeli officer. And the third one was shot dead in a settlement near Bethlehem. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has denounced the killings, saying that they reveal that the regime is gripped by fear. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also condemned the crimes in the occupied land. Tel Aviv has intensified raids and bloody crackdown following Palestinian operations in recent weeks that left more than a dozen Israelis dead.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subh Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical, and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
It's one form of the collective punishment adopted by the Israeli regime. They think these punishments will stop Palestinians or prevent their operations. Israel knows very well it has failed to prevent such operations, and we can see that the Palestinian resistance continues and even has gained momentum.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Muna Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Voting is underway in the Philippines to elect a new president. More than 65 million Filipinos are eligible to cast their ballots. 10 candidates are vying to succeed, incumbent Rodrigo Duterte. Only Marcos Jr., the son of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos, and his rival Lenny Robredo, the incumbent vice president, are seen the top contenders. Pre-election surveys show Marcos Jr. is heading for a landslide, as voter turnout is expected to be high. More than 60,000 security forces have been deployed to protect ballots and election workers. Polls opened at 6 a.m. local time on Monday and will continue until 7 p.m. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. I have a lot of indoor plants.
Watering these beautiful plants refreshes my spirit. They're like my children, and I love them very much. Just last week, I went to a pottery shop and bought some white pots for my plants. I chose the color white. I love this color. The contrast between the white of the pot and the green of the plant is very attractive. By the way, I said white. Before I forget, I'm going to visit Abya's palace today. Abya's palace literally means white palace. Stay with me. Abya's palace is one of the beautiful palaces of the complex of Golestan Palace, located at Arc Square in Tehran. This palace is on public display as the Museum of Anthropology. At late Nasiruddin Shah's ruling, Shah Sultan Abdul Hamid, the Ottoman king, sent some precious and expensive stuff to the king of Iran. Because at that time, all the palaces and royal halls were fully decorated with pictures and furniture, and there was no empty room left, Nasiruddin Shah decided to build a new palace at the southwestern corner of Golestan Palace and put the gifts of the Ottoman Sultan in that palace. This building is called Abya's Palace, literally White Palace, because the facade of the building is white and its plaster work is inspired by European premises dating back to the 18th century. The design of the doors and windows are also simple because of being inspired by the European architecture. However, the entrance of Abya's Palace is built based on geometric designs of the Qajarid architecture. I am now at the beautiful area of Abya's Palace. The beautiful building of the palace with its white plaster work and wooden doors and windows is exactly in front of me. There is also a beautiful balcony with four pillars just above the entrance door. I'm eager to see inside the palace as soon as possible. Let's go inside. I am now at the ground floor. This palace is currently one of the oldest and richest anthropology museums of Iran. On my right, there are interconnected rooms which display the lifestyle of people living in different corners of Iran. Oh, look! Charming! This room is home to a family belonging to the Qajarid era. The family members have all gathered together. On the right, there is a samovar as well as teawares, including cups and a teapot. And a lantern is also hanging from the ceiling. In this room, you can get familiar with the type of outfit and the simple lifestyle of the people living during the Qajarid era.
I am at the end of the corridor at the ground floor. Here, there is the replica of an old Iranian coffee house.
By using the stuff like samovar, barbecue and DZ pot, coffee house keeper, storyteller or naqal, as well as customers, this place reminds you of the old hangouts in Iran. Let's go to the second floor. I am now at the second floor of Abyas Palace. All of the chambers in the second floor display wax replicas, representing the men and women of different parts of Iran with their special outfit. These costumes are very pretty. I can't take my eyes off them. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the Islamic Republic. He was received by the leader of Iran's revolutionary Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who had kind words for him. He said that Syria enjoys a higher degree of respect and credit, and that all countries look upon it as a power. What does Syria's hard-fought status in both political and military arenas mean in the context of regional countries who used to act against it with the support of the U.S.? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how Syria's re-entrance into the region has been embraced by regional countries, which spells the end of U.S. dominance and influence. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Elijah Magnier joins us. He's a journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, and political analyst from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. If I may first start with you, Elijah McNair, and get your reaction to what Iran's leader has said. Quote, today Syria is not the same Syria that it was before the war. Syria enjoys a higher degree of respect and credit, and all countries look upon it as a power.
Thank you for having me. Syria is one of the rare countries who refused to normalize with Israel and declare Israel as an enemy and supported the Palestinian cause and refused to submit to the U.S. hegemony, notwithstanding the war waged on Syria since 2011. That's a very important point. Secondly, Syria is part of the axis of the resistance that reject the U.S. hegemony and fight for the oppressed people and to support the Palestinian cause and refuse any truce with Israel or normalization of the relationship like other countries in the Gulf. Third, the number of countries that were involved in the war in Syria, dozens of nations led by the U.S. to change the regime and create a failed state and allow the jihadists that were trained by the Americans and their NATO allies in Syria, in Jordan, in Turkey, this is a big victory for Syria and its allies, mainly Iran and Russia, who interfered in the war in Syria to the request of the government in Damascus in different stages in 2011, 2013, and 2015. That is very significant. Today, Syria has a different position where different Middle Eastern countries are trying to normalize the relationship and bring them back as they were before 2011, but they are forbidden by the Americans to regain this relationship, and Syria is not rushing toward them. It's reinforcing the relationship with Iran that holds more or less the same ideology and objectives against the Israelis and to support the oppressed, supporting the axis of the resistance and rejecting any U.S. hegemony over the country.
So, Marcus Papadopoulos, how do you go from what, as our guest there said, it's really incredible if you think about it, how many countries were involved in this war on Syria and how they really just went all out for so many years, to now Syria being received by these countries. Of course, we can talk about the UAE, which has warmly embraced Syria, both the foreign minister visiting Syria and then Assad visiting the UAE. And these are, of course, Arab countries that were backing this these terrorists. Why are they welcoming Syria now?
Well, the victory of the Syrian people in the war waged against them by the West through Western proxies, namely numerous terrorist groups, constituted a turning point, not just for the Middle East, but for the world as a whole. Though we should be mindful that not all of Syria has been liberated by the Syrian army, because there are two NATO countries inside Syria and illegally occupying Syrian territory. Thus, in the northeast, we have the Americans, and in the northwest, we have the Turks together with Al-Qaeda. But nevertheless, the victory of Syria really was quite astonishing, given everything that the Americans, the British, the French, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Israelis confronted the Syrian people with, not just in terms of the tens of thousands of terrorists which were deployed into Syria, but also the array of weaponry which was sent to them. So it really was a remarkable victory. And what we can say is this, that as a result of Syria's victory, an unofficial alliance comprising Syria, Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah has emerged in the Middle East. And that unofficial alliance is now confronting American supremacy in the Middle East. And whilst I'm not saying that the American stranglehold over the Middle East is on the verge of collapse, nonetheless, the Syrians, the Iranians, the Russians, and Hezbollah are able to limit the maneuvering of the Americans in the Middle East, which is good for peace in the Middle East, it's good for stability in the Middle East, and it means the Americans don't have the same kind of maneuverability to instigate another war in the Middle East as they have done on previous occasions.
Well, all of this comes, as you mentioned, I think Elijah Magner alluded to, in the face of the U.S., who says that it still stands against this, what it has called normalization, with what it considers to be the regime in Syria, as the U.S. Claims. They have slammed attempts, for example, by the UAE to have started this process, and they have said, as we have said it before, this administration will not express any support for efforts to normalize or to rehabilitate Bashar al-Assad. How is it that you have an ally like the UAE of the U.S., if I may say that? I mean, I'm not too sure if they're on solid footing right now, but how do you go from being an ally to what the UAE has done? Maybe the fallout maybe one of the reasons could be UAE's approach towards Syria.
Well, in politics, everything is possible. There aren't any swear enemy forever, including Saudi Arabia. The investment that Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar have made in Syria in supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS is huge. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars, as the Qatari foreign minister said in one of his interviews a couple of years ago. So today we see the Emiratis already establishing a diplomatic relationship with Damascus since a couple of years now. However, they are prevented from increasing and turning this diplomatic relationship into commercial relationship. Now, all that is because the Biden administration doesn't have a strategic view of what to do in Syria, and hopefully that will turn in the favor of the Syrian government, where they must start activating the resistance against the Turkish and the U.S. occupation forces, as your guest rightly said, in the north, east, and west. Now, the Saudis also don't have a good relationship with this current U.S. administration. However, there are some lines that are not crossed so far, like returning and regaining relationship with Syria, because they believe that this is a gift to President Assad that the Americans are not yet willing to do, waiting for the Syrian opposition to regain some strength from I don't know where, because they finished. And today we have only Al-Qaeda in Turkey in the north, and the American and their proxies, Kurds. So any plan is a failed plan, and they have to be convinced to regain relationship with the central government in Damascus.
Yeah, I almost forgot that there was a Syrian opposition. I'm not too sure how they're getting their funding. Marcus Papadopoulos, what is interesting here is the fact that you have the interest, to say the least, from the UAE to expand its business relation with Syria. And it has actually opened up the doors towards that. We can talk about the telecom sector, I believe, and also in the arena of electricity. But the sticking point here is the fact that you have the U.S. sanctions that are in place. Now, if they move ahead with those, then they will be in breach of sanctions. They're showing a keen interest, UAE, in expanding their relationship in the business arena. So how can they when these sanctions are in place?
Well, politics is a strange business. One day you are at war with another country, and the next day you are trading with that country. Prior to the war in Syria in 2011, Syria had a lucrative trading and business relationship with countries such as Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and UAE. And because the efforts of the West to topple the Syrian government and to impose a pro-Western puppet government in Damascus failed, and failed abysmally, there are countries in the Middle East which wish to resurrect its previous lucrative business dealings with Syria. So as you've already mentioned, UAE is one of them. And I have no doubt that at some point in the future, sooner rather than later, The Saudis will do the same, and the Turks will do the same. And I also believe the British and the French will do the same. And as regards possible sanctions on a country such as the UAE, which of course is a strategic partner to Washington, well, we have to bear in mind that whilst the Americans exercise tremendous influence in UAE, I do not believe that UAE is a puppet of the Americans, certainly not like how Serbia or Ukraine is a puppet of the American government. So I believe that UAE sees a very important imperative, an important economic imperative in re-establishing its trade relationship with Syria. And I do not believe that the Americans will impose sanctions on UAE because the Americans are acutely aware that they do not have the kind of maneuverability in the Middle East that they once had as a result of, as I mentioned earlier, the unofficial alliance of Syria, Iran, Russia and Hezbollah. The Americans are not going to sanction any of their allies in the Middle East at a time when American mastery in the Middle East is being challenged. That would simply be suicidal for the Americans.
Sure. Well, you know, it's very confusing to know what is the policy, Elijah Magnier, of the U.S. when it comes to Syria. I mean, really, even throughout the war, it was kind of confusing. I think it was categorized as an obsession with Assad being, you know, thrown off or for his position to get changed. Kind of like the same way that they're looking at Putin. Nevertheless, a question comes to mind. A, what is the U.S. position now when it comes to Syria and Assad? And B, what right does the U.S. even have to dictate and decide for other countries in the region with whom it should have a relationship with?
Well, first of all, the Americans don't have any right to dictate anything on any country, any sovereign country. However, because they are not accountable, they don't feel they need to ask permission from anyone, including the United Nations. That's one. Two, the Americans, the current American administration is really following what President Donald Trump has done in Syria and in other parts of the world, at the exception of the relationship with Russia. So we saw that he kept the Americans' forces in Syria and he kept the American forces in Iraq, despite the rejection of the Syrian government and the Iraqi parliament of the U.S. Forces presence in their respective countries. Now, Biden doesn't have a policy in Syria. He has one very specific policy to try and starve the population by controlling the oil and the food that is represent the biggest supply of the country in the northeast, where the U.S. forces are occupying. And he is also blocking the road and the borders on the Tanf between Syria and Iraq. So when he is doing that and preventing Jordan from regaining relationship with Syria, preventing the Arab Gulf countries from doing so, he is aiming to cripple the Syrian economy. That is his only clear policy. Otherwise, he doesn't have any other policy that is visible apart from that, because, first of all, Russia has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria. Iran has defeated the U.S. and NATO in Syria by spoiling their objectives and making sure that they will never reach the objective to create a failed state in Damascus. And thirdly, because Hezbollah became stronger due to the Syrian war. So giving Syria as a reward to Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah, this is not something that the Americans are very much willing to do. That's why they're keeping the forces in the north, and I don't think Biden will withdraw ever from a country without a local resistance.
So we need to connect the dots here between different entities that are involved here, Marcus Papadopoulos, and perhaps he can help us out here. So in terms of looking at the side where we want to see what U.S.'s position is, maybe it's good to bring Israel in here. And the reason why I'm bringing Israel in here is because you have the UAE that has normalized ties with Israel. So the U.S., who knows what's going on in terms of their policy, but Israel has formalized ties with the UAE, who has ties with Syria. So can you please explain to us how these relationship works when it comes to Syria?
Very quickly, the cardinal factor as to why the Americans attempted to overthrow the Syrian government was to eradicate Russian influence and power in the Middle East. Why? Because Syria, historically, has been Russia's eyes and ears in the Middle East. That's why Washington attempted to destroy the Syrian government through the use of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But as regards to how relations between Israel and a number of countries in the Middle East, Arab countries in the Middle East, have been normalized, such as UAE, well, that is, in my opinion, America's response to the victory of the Syrian people in the war in their homeland, because the Americans, through getting their allies in the region, such as Israel and UAE, to normalize their relationship with one another, that not only strengthens Israel, but it also, as a result, strengthens America's position in the Middle East. So whilst it is very true that America's position in the Middle East has been weakened somewhat by the victory of Syria in the war, nonetheless, the Americans are still able to bring together their allies in the region as a way of augmenting their mastery in West Asia. No different to how the Americans have formed an Eastern partnership in the Eastern Mediterranean involving Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, sure, and Saudi Arabia. So we need to be very mindful that the Americans, whilst they've been weakened in the Middle East, they are anything but a spent force there.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree, Elijah Magner, the way the media is reporting this and the way it's being reported in general in terms of the way that these overtures, if you want to call it, are being done between the Persian Gulf countries and Syria is one key motive, and that is said to stop the influence of Iran with Syria. But we see Assad visiting Iran today, meeting with the leader, who received them very warmly. And at the same time, you have the current administration, the 13th administration, headed by Ebrahim Raisi, who has made it a point, A, to establish close ties with regional countries, and B, Iran is in the middle of talks with Saudi Arabia, which there are talks of even the embassies opening up. So if you have that going on, how can there then be a relationship between these Arab countries with Israel, the ones who have formalized, when Israel's bombing Syria? Because they want to make investments in that country. At least that's part of the talk and report that they want to establish.
Well, look, we've seen the relationship between Russia and Turkey is a very strategic and excellent relationship, but they disagree on Syria. We've seen also the relationship between Iran and Turkey going into a very good level, but they disagree also on Syria because both Russia and Iran believe in the sovereignty of the Syrian state. Now, the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia is regaining. However, the Saudis are still occupying Yemen and not releasing all the goods to lift the sanctions on Yemen. So there are differences that can be organized in some countries and disagreed upon in other countries. Now, this is going to happen between Saudi Arabia and Iran, the regaining of the diplomatic relationship this month, because that is important, particularly when Iran shows strengths and its ability to stand against the U.S., and the nuclear deal is about to happen anytime if the Americans agree on the full Iranian terms. That's why it is in the advantage of the Saudis to have good ties with a strong country like Iran that is capable of defending itself and showed its capability, particularly after bombing the Mossad base in Iraq just a couple of weeks ago. Showing the Iranian capability, threatening Israel, and the Saudis having good relationship with Israel, they are two different things. The Saudis are pleasing the Americans. The Saudis are afraid of the Americans' reaction. They want to have good ties with the Israelis, but that doesn't mean the population in the Middle East agree what their leaders are doing, particularly in the Emirate, in Syria, in Damascus, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, in Jordan. There are different things here.
Well, a final question, Marcus Papadopoulos. When it came to Syria, Saudi Arabia and the allies and a bunch of countries that were on the same page, they lost that war. When it comes to Saudi Arabia, they have pretty much lost the war in Yemen. I'm guessing that they're saying, okay, it's time to maybe move and regroup with regional countries, Syria being one of them. The resistance, this is part of the resistance of this area, Syria, one part of that equation. When these countries align themselves with Syria, will that be the final blow for the U.S. in a sign that it should move out of the region?
While Saudi Arabia may have lost the war in Yemen, they have still nevertheless slaughtered over 200,000 Yemeni men, women and children through the use of British and American weapons. But the world is witness to the emergence of a very powerful Iranian state. And that is a reality that the Saudis cannot ignore. So the Saudis have two options. They can either have a war with Iran, which would be catastrophic for the Saudis, or they can have some sort of relationship with the Iranians. And that is why I believe that Riyadh will opt for the latter. They will establish some sort of relationship with Iran, because otherwise the Saudis could become embroiled in a war with the Iranians and Saudi Arabia would be decimated and the American hold over the Middle East would be then in serious jeopardy.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you for that, Marcus Papadopoulos, author, historian, political analyst. Elijah Magnier, pleasure, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadali, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today we are going to deal with a very important question and problem and misconception about the, I want to say Shia Islamic faith, but we will notice that this concept is actually present in Islam and not only in the Shia doctrine faith. And the question is as follows. Can tawassul, meaning to benefit from and use someone near to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as an intermediary and means of fulfilling one's request, can it be proved in the verses of the Holy Quran, or is tawassul a bid'ah, a man-made innovation?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. About the tawassul and asking some people or something else that I will expand on this, as an intermediary for asking some assistance, whether we are allowed to do that or not, we have many verses of Noble Quran talking about this issue. And you know that, my dear listeners and my esteemed host, that the Main question coming from Ibn Taymiyyah. Maybe he was a first who shed some doubts and question about the concept of tawassul.
Right.
And not only about this issue, about many other Islamic issues, he has put some doubts about and question about such Islamic teachings. But before Ibn Taymiyyah and even after Ibn Taymiyyah, we do not have such a point, and everything was clear for most of the scholars. Please look at the Majmu'atul Fatawa, which has been written by, Majmu'atul Fatawa actually is the collection of the, Majmu'atul Fatawa is collection of the books
Islamic
of,
rulings, right?
Yeah, not only Islamic rulings, we can say maybe to some extent most of the books of Ibn Taymiyyah, they have been collected and gathered into the, you know, in this Majmu'atul Fatawa. Of course, many other books written by Ibn Taymiyyah. Anyway, about the tawassul in the verses of Noble Quran, I want to say that even Ibn Taymiyyah accepts some part of the tawassul. And it was amazing for me to understand that.
Interesting.
He accepted some part of the tawassul, and he did not deny the tawassul and using some individual or something as a means for seeking some assistance, you see. For example, tawassul by Asma'ullah, the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He accepts that. Because according to the verse of Noble Quran, وَلِلَّهِ الْأَسْمَاءُ الْحُسْنَى فَدْءُوهُ بِهَا. Names for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The very best of names are to Allah.
Best of the names for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You should seek and you should remember him by his names. Or for example, tawassul in the and seeking assistance in the time of the some of the prophets. For example, قَالُوا يَا أَبَانَ اسْتَغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا إِنَّا كُنَّا خَاطِئِينَ. They came to the Prophet Yaqub and they asked him to ask forgiveness. And you know the story of Prophet Joseph.
Right.
They asked for forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the means of Yaqub. They asked Yaqub to ask forgiveness.
The Prophet.
Ya abana astaghfir lana dhunubana inna kunna khati'in. Qala sawfa astaghfiru lakum rabbi innahu huwal ghafurur rahim. And he accepted and said, I will do that. I will ask forgiveness from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala later, for example, in that specific time.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We have many other things, even about the noble Prophet Muhammad. وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ تَعَالَوْا يَسْتَغْفِرْ لَكُمْ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ لَوَّوْا رُؤُوسَهُمْ. When they have been told to come to the noble Prophet and ask him to do istighfar and forgiveness for them on behalf of them,
right,
they turn their faces and they refuse this idea. You see?
Interesting.
Another point with regards to that, for example, فَدْعُ لَنَا رَبَّكَ, talking about Prophet Moses, they ask him, يُخْرِجْ لَنَا مِمَّا تُنْبِتُ الْأَرْضِ. They ask Prophet Moses to ask your Lord to give us more blessing and mercy with regards to the
vegetables. They ask about onions and stuff and so on and so forth in the verse of the Quran.
Yes. Talking about the other prophets and even about the angels. وَالْمَلَائِكَةُ يُسَبِّهُونَ بِحَمْدِ رَبِّهِمْ وَيَسْتَغْفِرُونَ لِمَنْ فِي الْأَرْضِ.